He constantly recurs to the subject in his writings. He describes the awful agony of the condemned man and insists on the cruelty of inflicting such torture. Then followed 4 years of penal servitude spent in the company of common criminals in Siberia, where he began the Dead House, and some years of service in a disciplinary battalion. He had shown signs of some obscure nervous disease before his arrest, and this now developed into violent attacks of epilepsy from which he suffered for the rest of his life. The fits occurred 3 or 4 times a year and were more frequent in periods of great strain. In 1859, he was allowed to return to Russia. He started a journal, Vremya, which was forbidden by the censorship through a misunderstanding. In 1864, he lost his first wife and his brother Mikhail. He was in terrible poverty, yet he took upon himself the payment of his brother's debts. He started another journal, The Epoch, which, within a few months, was also prohibited. He was weighed down by debt, his brother's family was dependent on him, he was forced to write at heartbreaking speed and is said never to have corrected his work. The later years of his life were much softened by the tenderness and devotion of his second wife. In June 1880, he made his famous speech at the unveiling of the monument to Pushkin in Moscow, and he was received with extraordinary demonstrations of love and honor. A few months later, Dostoevsky died. He was followed to the grave by a vast multitude of mourners who gave the hapless man the funeral of a king. He is still probably the most widely read writer in Russia. In the words of a Russian critic who seeks to explain the feeling inspired by Dostoevsky, "He was one of ourselves, a man of our blood and our bone, but one who has suffered and has seen so much more deeply than we have. His insight impresses us as wisdom, that wisdom of the heart which we seek, that we may learn from it how to live. All his other gifts came to him from nature. This he won for himself, and through it he became great." Constance Garnett. Part 1. Chapter 1. On an exceptionally hot evening, early in July, a young man came out of the garret in which he lodged in S Place and walked slowly, as though in hesitation, toward K Bridge. He had successfully avoided meeting his landlady on the staircase. His garret was under the roof of a high 5-storied house and was more like a cupboard than a room. The landlady, who provided him with garret, dinners, and attendance, lived on the floor below, and every time he went out, he was obliged to pass her kitchen, the door of which invariably stood open. And each time he passed, the young man had a sick, frightened feeling which made him scowl and feel ashamed. He was hopelessly in debt to his landlady and was afraid of meeting her. This was not because he was cowardly and abject, quite the contrary. But for some time past he had been in an overstrained, irritable condition, verging on hypochondria. He had become so completely absorbed in himself and isolated from his fellows that he dreaded meeting not only his landlady, but anyone at all. He was crushed by poverty, but the anxieties of his position had of late ceased to weigh upon him. He had given up attending to matters of practical importance. He had lost all desire to do so. Nothing that any landlady could do had a real terror for him. But to be stopped on the stairs, to be forced to listen to her trivial, irrelevant gossip, to pestering demands for payments, threats, and complaints, and to rack his brains for excuses, to prevaricate, to lie, no. Rather than that, he would creep down the stairs like a cat and slip out unseen. This evening, however, on coming out into the street, he became acutely aware of his fears. "I want to attempt a thing like that, and am frightened by these trifles," he thought with an odd smile. Yes, all is in a man's hands, and he lets it all slip from cowardice. That's an axiom. It would be interesting to know what it is men are most afraid of. Taking a new step, uttering a new word, is what they